we're reading this morning in the Srimad Bhagavatam about the importance of the spiritual master. One cannot come to the precincts of Krishna consciousness unless he touches the dust of the lotus feet of a person who has become a Mahatma. And by sincerely rendering service to a bona fide spiritual master, one begins the spiritual life in Krishna consciousness. And one must surrender to a bona fide spiritual master, only this process will help one. These are the comments Srila Prabhupada made on this text number 20 in the 26th chapter of the 4th canon of Srimad Bhagavatam. So tonight, I've been advertised to give a little history of Srila Prabhupada in terms of my own entry into Krishna consciousness, or in other words, how I came to Krishna consciousness. So this is a little autobiographical as well. And Amarama was suggesting that the most interesting thing is the initial contact, stories we all like to hear from one another, how I came to Krishna consciousness. So I'll explain a little about myself at the time and then how I discovered Srila Prabhupada. It was in 1966, and I was in New York. For about 3 years, I had been working in New York City as a musician. I was in the musicians' union. I was a keyboardist, and I also did contracting for other bands, and I also did some simple orchestrations and copied music for jazz musicians. And I had read the Bhagavad Gita. Juan Mascaro's translation of Bhagavad Gita. And I had a lot of books in my place of different philosophies I was interested in. And this place I lived in New York was what's called an artist-in-residence loft. One who could qualify as an artist could live in a big empty building space. This one was maybe 1.5 times to twice the size of this temple, and it was converted into rooms. So I had one section was a studio. It's full of musical instruments and a couple of pianos and all kinds of other things, stringed instruments, Indian instruments. And this was a very poor part of town, the Bowery District, so the rent was very cheap. It was equivalent of about $65 Australian dollars a month. So it was at that time, I was 24 years old, that I was crossing Manhattan in New York, very nearby where I was living. This was a living and a studio, this place. I had decorated it, purchased it from another artist, so it was all sort of decorated and divided into rooms. Told me that there was a Swami who was lecturing on the Bowery, and that he thought I should see him or go and meet him. That was the first thing I ever heard about Srila Prabhupada. Now before this I had been to upstate New York, not upstate, but up what's called Upper Manhattan, uptown New York City, to a Vedanta center where a Swami lectured, but I had a very difficult time hearing him. And most of the people in the audience were much older than I was, and sitting in leather-like looking big padded stuffed chairs, some were smoking pipes, and it seemed to be a very stagnant sort of setting, both from the audience and the speaker's side. He seemed to talk in a bit of a monotone, and it was kind of inconclusive. So I didn't go back, but I kept getting postcards, come to the Vedanta Center, come to the Vedanta Center every few weeks. I never went back. And I had also visited a Zen master. There was a the first Zen Institute, and a group chanted monosyllabic, O-go-ro-me-pe-day. An old Zen master sat there. Then the little group of people went into a room afterwards and discussed their personal problems and how they fasted and so on. And again, they were kind of middle-aged people, and I didn't relate very well to them, didn't think there was really much to learn. Another occasion, a friend took me to meet a Christian priest who he said was a very elevated person, and in a big church in Manhattan. And I found him to be very disappointing. As I said, I'd read the Bhagavad Gita. After I read this little translation of Bhagavad Gita, I asked a friend of mine who was from India, what does this mean? Does it mean that after all this philosophical dialogue, this very elevated discussion, that they went and had a big war anyway? And the answer I got was, well, it's just a symbolic representation. It just means that you have to fight your life. You have to fight for your life. So then I became even more bewildered. And sort of distanced myself from the Bhagavad Gita, because that just didn't make any sense to me. So that was the setting, and I thought, well, if he's in the Bowery, maybe it's not so bad, because this is a very poor part of town. In fact, right on the Bowery itself, the Bowery Street, were, especially in the summertime, many, many alcoholics. The street is known for that. And in the summertime, you'll see them sort of lying about on the sidewalks. And in the summertime, the air smells like a mixture of urine and beer. There are flop houses all up and down, and bars, and pubs, taverns. People are drinking. Mostly winos, we call them, alcoholics. So this was intriguing, a Swami in the Bowery. I thought, well, at least he's not one of these uptown Swami types. And it was very intriguing, actually. So I took the address down, and then I made my appearance. It was, he mentioned that it was Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I came to the address, and there were two drunken men sitting on the step in front of the doors. There were two doors and one step. And they were sitting on this stoop, both very drunk, and they didn't want to let me pass. They were drinking their obnoxious old selves. And so I had to kind of shove my way through the door. And as soon as I got on the other side of the door, I was in a dark chamber, completely dark. And I just stopped, and then I heard the ching of the kartals in the distance, from up above. Very faint. Ching, 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 like that. And I waited to see if the area would lighten up a little bit, but it didn't. But I figured there was a stairway that would go up to the kartals. So I sort of felt up my way along the wall, one wall, and there were stairs, and I just felt my way up the stairs. There were four flights. And of course the sound got louder as I moved up the stairway. There was a landing at each level. At the top, there was a door with some light behind it coming through the chinks in the door. And then when I opened it, I heard the kartals. And this was also a loft. It was another artist in residence loft who had rented it or given it to Srila Prabhupada. Also a big room. But this was not decorated. This room had no ceiling. There were big cobwebs, spider webs, draped across the big, bare wooden beams on the ceiling. There were no lights, except at the far end of the room was a light, bare light bulb hanging from a wire. And it was very dark. The room wasn't well lit at all. And the furnishings were very meager. There wasn't much there at all. A couple of stuffed chairs that were sort of falling apart. And not much of a carpet. And it looked something like a bohemian artist's residence, which is in fact what it was, because Harvey Cohn, who rented this place to Prabhupada, was a bit of a bohemian artist. He was an artist. He wasn't using this place. He let Prabhupada have it. Then at the far end of the room, I could see Prabhupada, a little faint and a group of people sitting in front of me sat on a dais about 18 inches off the ground, about 3 by 2 meters, with a room divider behind him, one of these, I forget exactly what it looked like, but it was something that was like a backdrop. So he sat very erect, and I think he was playing this little African-like drum, and the others were playing kartals. And he had a beige-colored skivvy, a woolen, that came very high. And he had red glasses with very thick rims. And his eyes were closed most of the time. He was chanting. And the people were, a few had cymbals, and they were responding, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So I felt kind of comfortable there because I liked Indian music anyway. And I'd even taken a course from an exchange teacher who'd come from India on an exchange program at Columbia University. So I had some kind of an informal course. And so I felt kind of comfortable. I sat down cross-legged and started to chant along with everybody. I wasn't really 100% sure about the words, or maybe they weren't pronouncing them right, but I tried to chant. And then the kirtan ended, and of course all attention was riveted on Srila Prabhupada. He looked very distinguished, and he had a very prominent kind of aura, very attractive looking. And then he began to speak. He spoke in English with lots of Sanskrit. And his words were very hard for me to understand in the beginning, partly because he had a very heavy accent and also because he spoke in a very high voice. It was a very urgent, pleading voice. If any of you have heard some of the 1966 lectures, some of them are like that. It sounds like he's making a very urgent, urgent appeal, as if something very dangerous is about to happen, or something very urgent. There's a very urgent sound in his voice, and it's very high, very unusual. You don't hear tapes of Prabhupada like that. There are very few of them. And later on, he didn't have that sense of urgency in the sound of his voice when he spoke. But it gave the impression of a person who was very committed, very dedicated and sincere, and very intent upon getting his message across. And he kept saying, I'm not this body. As if, can't you see, you fools? I'm not this body. In that kind of a tone. And every once in a while it would recur. And I kept thinking, what does this mean? What does this mean? I'm not this body. And I kept drawing all my attention. I kept thinking about, what does this mean? And because of the way he said it, I began to think that somehow maybe he's not his body. I don't know about myself or anyone else, but it was just something that was very hard to ignore and think that there wasn't great truth in it, especially because he wasn't saying, you are not your body, in a kind of proselytizing way. He was saying it about himself, so it was much more easy to accept as a possibility. And I kept mulling this over and over. How is he not this body? And maybe he's not, maybe he's from some other planet. I don't know exactly what I was thinking, but I was trying to compute the meaning of this. So a lot of the other things he said were kind of going by. Many of them were difficult to understand. That's the thing I remember most clearly. So after he finished and asked for questions, I asked him, if you were passing on the street and you saw a young man beating an old man, would you stop and interfere, or would you walk on? What would be the correct spiritual thing to do? So Prabhupada launched into a very long answer. The conclusion was that you had to act on the spiritual platform. Unless you were situated on the spiritual platform, and I had no idea at all what the spiritual platform was, you would never know how to act, and you couldn't act in the right way. So I was always reading these different philosophies and trying to grapple with these various ethical issues and try to figure out what was spiritual. So I was pretty mundane and argumentative, and I said, well, I don't think you really answered my question. What would you do? And then he explained some more about the spiritual platform, and I was pretty lost. And in the end, I think, when I tried to sort of pin it down, would it be proper to interfere? He said yes. I don't remember exactly what the context was. Somehow, I felt sort of satisfied. It was a kind of a standoff. But I didn't really care so much, because this was all just philosophy to me, which I didn't think necessarily would come to precise conclusions, because most of what I was reading didn't anyway. So then there was another kirtan. And the mood sort of lightened up again, and I was trying to chant a little more sincerely. But I felt that at least I was able to talk with him. The other so-called spiritualist that I'd gone to see, I couldn't really even talk to. It was just sort of like there was no communication there. With the Swami, I didn't even try. But the Christian, I said a few words, and then he did most of the talking of things that were not really very spiritual. And the Zen master didn't show up for the meeting. So I just thought it was great that he would even talk. And, you know, there was actually some dialogue going on. So I began to feel a little satisfied. Anyway, after the kirtan, I thought, now is my chance. I can actually go and talk with him, because he's sitting right there. I mean, it's my chance. And I didn't have a plan as to what I would say, but I just walked up to him, and he was sitting on his dais there, and I was standing up. So he was looking up, and I was looking down, and he had this big grin on his face, almost like a child would. And I had that kind of feeling of him being like a little child, and it felt a little foolish. And without really having any idea about what I was going to say, I just heard myself saying, I have a tambura. And he just kept that big smile up, and he said, then bring it. And later on, when I thought about this, I remembered that there was so much affection there that he was, you know, kind of indirectly reminding me of my grandfather, because my grandfather was very affectionate, and he looked very much like Prabhupada. And in a kind of indirect way, or subtle way, there was that same feeling. So that was very disarming, because I was actually intending to have some kind of discussion with him. But being a musician, I thought, well, what more could I ask? It's an opportunity to come and accompany the great master. I can just bring my tambura and have a real nonverbal communion with him. That's what was going on in my mind in a subtle way, without articulating what was happening. And then I was thinking to myself that, well, there's no need to pursue any more discussion, because I can just come here. Now I'm part of the... I've made it. I've arrived. I'm part of the team. I can come and play my tambura with Srila Prabhupada. I mean, I didn't even know what his name was. I couldn't even pronounce it. But I thought, that's it. I'll come back next time there's nothing, no need to discuss anything. This would be a much better thing to do than to just talk at this time. So somehow I was going to talk, and I wanted to say something more, but I just couldn't think of anything. And Prabhupada was just smiling. So it was so unexpected that I just kind of excused myself and made an inner resolve to come back with my tambura next time and take it to the next stage. So that's what happened. The lectures were three nights a week, so I came back this time with the tambura. It was one of those, pretty big tambura. And when I came through, I think there was one other thing that happened that I forgot to mention. Maybe it's not very significant, but when I first came in and I was walking towards Prabhupada, I don't know if he even saw me, but I was trying to be polite, and so I knew that this was the proper etiquette. Offered some pranams, but I didn't see any response. He was so absorbed in the chanting. So this time when I came back with the tambura, he was somehow noticing me. And almost as soon as I came through the door, he went like this. And I just kept walking towards him. And I saw he was making some sort of a gesture, but I didn't know what it meant. And I'd never seen anybody do this before. So I just kept walking and kind of hesitating, kind of falteringly waiting for the next sign. Maybe he was going to go like this, or I didn't know what. And he, every once in a while, he would just do this again and kind of make a little nod of his head. Finally, I was standing right in front of the dais, a little over to one side, and he just looked at me and he went like that. So then I knew it couldn't be anything else but sit down. So I just sat down right in front, and he was already chanting. So I tried to tune my tambura to the melody, the raga that he was playing, trying to figure out what scale it was. And I think I spent most of that kirtan trying to tune the instrument to the raga. I kept changing it and twisting the knobs and moving the little silk thread up and down. And every once in a while I look up at Prabhupada and he just was completely oblivious. He was just chanting. I was looking to see if he was going to acknowledge anything. And he wasn't. So then I would think, well, actually maybe that's the wrong scale. Maybe he's really singing in this raga. And then I would change it again. He didn't ever acknowledge anything, good, bad, or indifferent one way or the other. He was just totally absorbed. So I thought, well, someday I'll figure out what raga he was singing in. It was all very enjoyable anyway. I mean, it was like a privilege. So then he spoke again. And this time I began to get used to his accent. I could hear better what he was saying. And it was either the next time or the time after. I didn't come because on the weekends sometimes I would work. Usually I only worked on the weekends. I was a pretty lazy fellow. And so when I came back the following Monday, after not having been there on the Friday, first I just kind of came in and I thought, let's just, here I am again. And he said, where were you? And I said, I had to work. And he went, like that. And I was really startled, a little amazed that he was so kind of taciturn all of a sudden. And he didn't seem very pleased at all, even though it seemed a perfectly normal thing to do. One has to work to live. But he wasn't satisfied. And I felt actually guilty that I didn't go somehow. And I could see that he was actually disappointed. It wasn't just... maybe it wasn't because I was working, but just the fact that I wasn't there. And it made me feel that he was really looking for more of a commitment. And I felt more obliged and more committed to be part of his mission. Subtly, I felt like that because of his attitude of being unaccepting about having missed one of these sessions. Somehow, that he felt this was very important to me, much more than I did. But there was also a feeling of caring. He really cared that I should be there because it was good for me. So that made a very deep impression on me. It was exactly the opposite of what I expected. I mean, I didn't really expect anything, but I certainly didn't expect him to be so to be disapproving. I mean, I didn't even think he would even ask. But then when he asked and expressed this kind of subtle form of disapproval, it really made me think. And it made me realize how committed he was to carrying out his mission, which I still didn't quite know what it was yet. I don't want to leave anything important out. Then I think it was the next session, or before the next session. Oh, I know what it was. This is what I wanted to say. There was a young boy there who lived with Prabhupada. He had been given this loft on condition that he would have to stay with young Paul, who was called David in the Sri Prabhupada Lilamrita for some legal reasons. And Paul Murray was about 18 years old. Every time we were in this loft, he would be serving Prabhupada like a menial servant. And it became very clear that there was such a thing as someone who becomes like a servant of a guru, or someone who is completely surrendered. That's the mood that we picked up on. He was just ready to run and do everything. He was very young and he seemed to just respond instantly to whatever Prabhupada wanted. And that was also a little, it was a different thing. It was an unusual thing to see. And I couldn't quite understand whether it was just that he was very nervous and high strung, or it was just very dedicated, or a combination of those things, or whether Prabhupada was somehow very heavy in ordering him to be a certain way. It was never clear why he was acting that way. But when Prabhupada acted disappointed that I wasn't there, I started thinking a little more in a very subtle way about this Paul and what his relationship was with Prabhupada and what kind of a relationship I might have with Prabhupada. And I could see that it was a way of sort of pulling me in that direction of being some sort of a more servile person or a servant. So then one of the guests there was a friend of mine. I had known him, not the one who first told me. He actually never came. He'd said that, you know, that Swamiji has some books. And I said, no, I didn't know he had any books. He said, yeah, they're on the bookshelf when you come in. And I'd seen a row of books that looked like the same book over and over again on the bookshelf. And it was the first canto of the Bhagavatam, the first three parts. So he said, no, you should get these books. You can buy them. You can get them directly from Swamiji. So I thought, well, this is great. He's actually got books. I was surprised to hear this. So when I went the next time, first thing I said to him is, I understand you have some books. I'd like to buy them. He said, oh, yes. And immediately, from behind somewhere, just handed me these three books. I said, oh, okay, how much is it? And he said, $15. And I just didn't have any. I said, oh, I don't think I have $15. I was, you know, getting my wallet. I said, I only have $5. He said, that's all right. You can give me that and pay the rest later. So I was kind of disarmed again. I said, oh, thank you. Thank you very much. And he was very happy to give me these books. He was beaming again, looked very bright and happy that I was interested in the books. So when I started reading the Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada took on a completely new dimension. And I became very engrossed in reading. I tried to stop more or less everything else I was doing. And if I had to go outside somewhere, I would just carry the book, and I remember reading it as I was walking down the street, even crossing the street, sitting on the bus. And I was very struck by the description of Kali Yuga, Manda to Manda Matayo, how the people of this age are very unfortunate. Somehow, that translation, they're misguided, unlucky, and unfortunate, really stuck in my mind, because there's so many books that one could read then about all the anomalies that were going on in the world. But somehow none of them ever described the condition of humanity as unfortunate. there were always so many things wrong that had their causes and effects. But this was such a deep understanding that it was just misfortune. It was widespread misfortune. It just seemed to make so much sense. There didn't really seem to be any other explanation about Kali Yuga, why it was the way it was, except that it was just bad. It was misfortune. So that struck me. And then as I began to read more and more and more, I think I went through the first volume very quickly, maybe in a day, I don't remember, but just at a certain point I was on the bus and I thought to myself that this is absolute knowledge. This is the absolute truth. This is what I've been looking for. And Prabhupada is the person who's bringing it. So it just sort of settled in my mind that he wasn't an ordinary person. I mean, he was a very wonderful person, but by having read the Bhagavatam, I could understand that he was the personification, the author of these books, and the personification of this knowledge. So then things began to take on a different look, and I began to think that whatever he's saying, it must be right, and that whatever he wants done, somehow it should be done, although I certainly wasn't prepared to be a Paul Murray at that point. Then I was on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning, sleeping late, and the phone rang at about 7 o'clock, and it was Carl. Carl was the friend who turned me on to Prabhupada's books and who was helping Prabhupada. He was kind of the main facilitator, you might say, of Prabhupada's mission, which I still didn't really know much about. And he said, how are you? And I said, I don't know, I just woke up. And he said, well, Swamiji and I were just out taking a walk and we thought we'd come up and see you. And I looked at my watch and it was just a blur. And I looked again and I said, it's 7 o'clock in the morning, are you crazy? And it's Sunday morning. He said, no, he said, no, we were just out walking, and I think Swamiji really wants to see you. I said, but it's 7 o'clock in the morning. I'm not even up. And then he kind of paused. I said, he didn't really know what to say, and he said, finally said, well, Swamiji really wants to see you. And he just stopped, and I was trying to figure out what to do, and I just felt like I had no choice. So I said, well, where are you? He said, well, we're in a telephone booth, just almost right in front of your place. So then I started to wake up very fast. And so as quickly as I could, but while I was still getting dressed, there was a knock on the door. And so as quickly as I could. And they were both looking very bright and awake. And so I invited them in. And we sat on a couch. It was in the front part of this loft, like a little living room. And Carl sat on one end. Prabhupada sat in the middle, and I sat on the other side. And there was a cat lived up there, a little house cat, which immediately jumped up on Prabhupada's lap. And his left hand, he just slapped it off. And it went screeching. And as cats do. I was thinking, no, this is not very usual behavior for a holy man. I wonder what he has against cats. Anyway, I just sort of let it pass off. So we started talking, just a small talk, and then I hadn't noticed that the television set opposite this couch had been left on from the night or the day or maybe even 2 days before. I wasn't a great television watcher, but it was on a lot of the time. And there were cartoons playing. The sound was off. That's why I didn't notice it. And we were talking, and then Prabhupada started looking at this TV, and he said, this is nonsense. And all of a sudden I looked up and saw that it was still on, and I saw what it was, and I stood up as if I was very indignant. And for the first time I realized how nonsensical cartoons were, and I said, yes, this is nonsense. And I walked over and switched it off. So then we started talking again, and Prabhupada said that Paul is, he's become very crazy. And I asked him how, and he said, well, he said, I've asked him to put the soap in the shower, in the dish, but he keeps forgetting to do it. And he leaves it on the floor. So, and I asked him again, after many times, he became very angry, and he ill-named me. And then he just looked at me. I was starting to think what was actually, what Prabhupada was getting at, what was actually going on. So then I looked at Carl to try to get some indication about what I was supposed to say. And he said something about that Swamiji is having a lot of trouble. And I said, what kind of trouble? And then Prabhupada looked at me again and he said, we have a saying in India that you should find a spiritual master and you should sit opposite him and learn everything he has to teach you. And then once you've learned everything, then you should kill him. Then you move his dead body aside and then you sit in his place and you become a spiritual master. And then I thought for a couple of seconds and Prabhupada was looking right at me and then he said, he is a very dangerous man. Kind of looking out of the side of his eyes. He's a very dangerous man. And then I became a little alert that something, you know, was very unsavory was going on over there. And so then I looked up to Carl as if to say, well, what do we do now? I mean, what am I supposed to say? So he said, well, so how can we help Swamiji? So then I started thinking, well, maybe he wants to sort of, you know, make me into a Paul and move up into my place here. And so I immediately thought, that means the end of my material life. I have to just be like Paul, give everything up, and become an obsequious servant of this Swami. So I immediately explained to Prabhupada what my situation was there, how I was having people come, and we were rehearsing, and I was writing music, and on and on. I just made it very clear that I couldn't offer him my place. He didn't actually say that's what he wanted, but it could have been. So then Carl said that he could offer him a place, I think it was his place, for 1 or 2 days. But that was all. And Prabhupada said that he had one friend, a Dr. Mishra, who lived in New York, where he had stayed before, where he could put up. Both Carl and I don't know about Carl, but I felt very kind of ashamed and guilty that I couldn't do something more, that I couldn't sort of just, you know, let and maybe offer Prabhupada my place or do just something, because he was going to have to leave that place. It was very unsuitable. So somehow I started to say, well, we'll have to find you some place. I didn't really know what that was going to be, but I felt very obliged. So I got Prabhupada's telephone number and then decided somehow try to help him. So a few days went by, and somehow the idea came to me that if there could be a store, a shopfront, that that would be better than being, and in a better location than up in the top floor of the Bowery loft. So I don't think I really planned this or thought about it too much before, but I just sort of felt I had to do something. So I knew that these storefronts were available through one newspaper. It came out once a week. And if you got to the ads early enough, these little classified ads for premises, that you could possibly get one. So I went to the place where this newspaper came out. It was called the Village Voice. I knew the newsstand that it arrived at first. And as soon as they came out, I got the paper and started looking and went into a phone box nearby and made a phone call about a storefront. And it actually worked out that this storefront became a temple later on. So I made an appointment to go see the rental agent, and then I went back to my place and I called Srila Prabhupada and Carl and explained that this place was available and that we could go look at it. So we made an appointment to see this rental agent the next day, or maybe it was 2 days later. So this was still on the Lower East Side. It's not what you could call an upscale neighborhood by any means, but it was light years better from what was on the Bowery. It was also very accessible, and there were a lot of young people in the area. And it was, you know, possibly affordable. So I got there early, and this Mr. Gardner came, and I told him a little about what we wanted to do there. I just told him about Prabhupada, basically, and that he would be giving classes there. And he was I was worried that he wasn't going to like the idea. So I tried to present Prabhupada as a scholar and a teacher, more than as a saint and a sage and a holy man from India. And he just seemed very happy with the idea. And then Carl and Prabhupada came a little bit later. But by this time, I was thinking that it wouldn't really be such a problem, because he seemed quite favorable. So when Prabhupada came along, he didn't seem to be worried that he was a foreigner or anything else. He just seemed to be in a very good mood. Appreciated Prabhupada's erudition and discussed this with him. And then, of course, Carl was also some kind of a scholar. I don't remember what his field was, but he was one of these sort of real scholarly type of guys. So we had a very interesting discussion out in front of 26 Second Avenue. Then we went inside and started negotiating. And first of all, we looked at it and we asked Prabhupada if it would serve as a temple, and he was thinking, yes, this is good. And Mr. Gardner offered an apartment across the courtyard in the same building. The storefront would be $100. It was $125, I think, and the apartment was $85. He said he could paint it and have it ready. So Prabhupada explained that myself and Carl, he used to call us Mr. with our first names afterwards, Mr. Carl and Mr. Michael. He said they're trustees of our society, and I'd like you to be a trustee as well. He seemed kind of flattered. Okay. And Prabhupada talked on a bit, and then he said, our trustees, they all pay a subscription, monthly subscription of $25 per month. So he was a little startled, and he didn't say anything. And then Prabhupada said, but if you like, you can just deduct it from our rent. So then he said, all right, all right. He was kind of easygoing. I think later on he sort of reneged on that, but For at least the first few months, he was quite happy. Maybe it went on for a year, I'm not sure. But anyway, he was quite favorable. And then he discussed about this apartment, and he said he could paint it and have it ready within a few days, if we could wait that long. And we haven't even figured out how to pay for it or if we were even going to take it. So Carl and I had a discussion there with Prabhupada and Mr. Gardner, and we just figured that somehow that we would get the money within a few days, pay the rent, and Prabhupada could move there. So Prabhupada seemed quite happy to do that. And that became the temple very shortly after that. One thing that I forgot to mention was that on the Bowery, I'd asked Prabhupada to consider giving Sanskrit classes. So he said, yes, we can do it on Saturday morning. So I turned up on Saturday morning. A few people had come. I purchased some books on Sanskrit, especially I was interested in, you know, the calligraphy aspect of it. This book showed how to make all the characters. Anyway, Prabhupada was up there, standing up this time, not sitting at his dais in the usual way, but he was standing, and he stood next to this easel-like thing with an old crumbling chalkboard, really crumbling around the edges and crumbling on the surface, and a piece of chalk. And on the board he had written the verse in the Brahma Samhita, Ishvara Parama Krishna, Satchidananda Vigraha, Nadi Radha Govinda Sarva Karana Karanam, in English. And he spent almost the whole class teaching us that verse. Of course, we learned how to write it in Sanskrit, too, during the course of the class. He put the Devanagari on the board. But he actually taught us the verse, and I remember we all walked out of there, at least I did, I knew that verse. And of course, I know the meaning of it, too. So while he was teaching Sanskrit, he was teaching us that Krishna is the supreme controller, cause of all causes. Very nice. And the embodiments of knowledge, eternity, and bliss. So that was the one and only Sanskrit class I attended. Somehow or other, I don't know if our attendance fell off or the move to Second Avenue happened before that. But it was wonderful to see Prabhupada in a different phase of his personality. He was the teacher. That he was teaching Krishna consciousness through Sanskrit. And he was, you know, very also responsive. It was just because one of the guests, I don't want to call it students, because we really weren't even students, asked him, so he did it. And also, to go back to the Bowery for a minute, he was, I'll relate a couple of more things. One day he had a little powwow with us after the class, and he said that he would like to have a love feast, a festival up there in that Bowery room. And I was thinking, how can this be? He said, if there's a festival, there's singing and dancing and refreshments, everybody will enjoy, nobody will object. And he was trying to popularize the idea so that we could bring other guests there. And what it ended up being was a feast, basically. There wasn't much else going on. Prabhupada didn't really even give a talk, but he got one of the girls who was coming to help him. He made kachoris, he made a sabji with chickpea flour, and there were samosas and a number of other things which I don't remember very well. I remember that I really liked this sabji made with chickpeas. But the thing that was really interesting about it was that Prabhupada wasn't sitting on his dais or up near a blackboard. He was on the other side of the room where there was a big round table about 6 feet in diameter. And it was filled with pots of cooked prasadam. And Prabhupada was in the role of a host, a very jovial host. He wasn't a teacher or a lecturer, he was a host. And he was extremely gracious and congenial, just smiling and talking to each person, asking what they were doing and how they liked this preparation and that preparation. And he was personally serving things out. And it was the first time that we were standing and Prabhupada was standing up, so we were aware of his stature. He was actually a lot shorter than almost all of us. And he had this kind of childlike countenance that was emphasized by the fact that he was so much shorter than we were. in his hand and serving it out, sort of really almost forcing it on with his ineffable smile and his personality. You couldn't really refuse. So that was his mood. It was just, you know, how sometimes when we're serving prasadam at the feast, we just feel very happy to serve prasadam more than eating prasadam. So that was Prabhupada's mood. And I couldn't figure out why he was so happy. You know, it was just giving out this food, which we didn't even know what it was. Why he was so happy and so joyful. It was a completely different facet, a different facet of his personality. And it was very hard to figure out. Somehow I was always trying to figure things out. But it was just another dimension to Srila Prabhupada's persona that had never been manifested before. He was very, very happy. I didn't really appreciate it or understand it until later, that he was actually feeling spiritual bliss serving prasadam. So one morning before he made the move to Second Avenue, it was after the first couple of visits, I decided I wanted to go up and pay him a personal visit. So this was the first time I would have gone there during the daytime. The door was locked, and the bell didn't seem to be working, wasn't getting any response. So I started with my hands cupped and head tilted up towards the window, yelling, "Paul, Paul," as loud as I could, thinking Paul would come to the window. But there's a great roar of traffic. Trucks are going in both directions, four lanes, two in each direction. Very noisy place. And I was sure I was getting drowned out. But I was sure Paul and Prabhupada were up there. So I took to throwing pennies up at the window, up to the fourth story. And I only had one, so I had to retrieve it each time. And I missed the first few times and finally started hitting the window. And I was expecting Paul would, you know, throw up the window and look out. And all of a sudden, Prabhupada did that. And he was looking at me, and he just kind of nodded his head and raised his finger as if to say, "I'll be right down." And I thought, oh no, I've made him walk. I'm going to make him walk all the way down and all the way back up four flights of stairs. I felt really awful, really embarrassed and offensive. Anyway, Prabhupada came very quickly and opened the door and smiled, said, "Come on." And I said, "I'm really sorry, I didn't mean to make you." I said, "Never mind, just come on, come on." And he lifted up the front of his dhoti and he was taking the stairs two at a time. I was really amazed. I'd never seen him go upstairs before. And I was trying to apologize again from behind, but he was sort of off and running there. And I didn't seem to even give it a thought. So then for the first time when we were up there, I went on the other side of the room divider, which was just the backdrop for his lecture. And there was about maybe 7 or 8 feet of space between that divider and the front part of that building, which looks onto the street through three windows. And there were lions with his clothes hanging on them. And an old typewriter. I forget, what's that brand of typewriter? It's very, very old. Anyway, it was one of those old models. And very ancient looking, and manuscripts stacked all over his Bhagavad Gitas. And I immediately understood much more than ever before what a condition he was living in. He was washing, it appeared, maybe he wasn't, but it appeared that he was kind of doing his own clothes, hanging them up to dry. I mean, this was the washing machine culture, you know, you never hang up your clothes to dry. And the labor that was going into, you know, pounding out these manuscripts with an old typewriter, it was just inconceivable. And he was in very, I mean, then I began to understand that this was a very serious thing. He was translating books and living in a way that I couldn't even comprehend someone could live. There was no visible way that he could even maintain himself there. So I sort of put that aside. I mean, I sort of took it in, but I didn't make any comment. But he was just so happy and happy to see me that there was no need to ask, well, you know, how are you living here, and so on and so forth. So I was more, of course, interested in, you know, just talking and getting some information. Very selfish, I suppose. So I wanted to know some things about Gandhi and Nehru in India. So we talked for, Prabhupada did most of the talking for quite a long time. And He told about some of the historic events that took place in India, mostly the ones that led up to the partition and the independence. And he really shattered my illusions about Nehru and Gandhi. You know, we have sort of fixed ideas about these people were great crusaders and so on. But he knew a lot of things that obviously I didn't know. And so it was kind of like the inside history of India. So many things that we've heard from Prabhupada since then. I was very intrigued by all this. So then the conversation turned a little bit more to myself and what was I doing. So I explained to him a little bit more. This was before he came, before the trouble with Paul started. And I told him about that I was a musician and that I had intentions actually to go into India and study in the near future. And that I was going to study the flute for one thing. He said, "Oh, don't you know that the flute players in India, they vomit blood?" I was so shocked. I didn't know what to say. I just never heard this before. I was trying to figure out what it meant. And I was going to ask him, but I just thought, "Oh, I'll have to think about this one." And then he wanted to know what my instrument was. And I told him mostly the keyboard, the piano. And he said, "Well, I can teach you how to play the piano for Krishna." And then I really had a hard time understanding that too. I thought that you could play a tambura and a flute for Krishna, but piano didn't seem possible. But I also had this feeling that Prabhupada was drawing me into his mission, steering me away from flute playing in India into piano playing in America for Krishna with him somehow. But I couldn't understand how it could work. So I just kind of let that slide by, and I think the subject got changed and went on to some other topics. And I knew I'd have to kind of really think about all these things. But again, there was that kind of sense of Prabhupada wanting to make me part of his mission and work for him. That came in. So I think I'm getting a little bit over the time I was going to talk. Admiram and I thought it might be good if any of you'd like to ask anything, we can have 5 or 10 minutes. I thought it was very elevated. There were two things I thought. First of all, that I can't understand about 30 or 40% of it just because I can't understand his accent. And the part that I could understand, I thought it was extremely deep and high philosophy and very esoteric and beyond my comprehension. That was basically what I was thinking about. And when I heard a few things that made a lot of sense to me, I sort of tuned myself out of things that were hard to understand and tried to focus in on the things that he said about not being this body. And I just sort of have this vague recollection that when he spoke of Krishna, when he pronounced Krishna, that it was with such conviction and with such a relish in the sound of his voice that I could see that he was a very deeply attached. And there was something very special about the way he pronounced Krishna's name. It was something very extraordinary. He didn't know what it was. He didn't know who Krishna was.
It wasn't until you got books and decided to get a deep understanding of the reading.
Yes, because, as I said, I had difficulty in understanding. And maybe somehow I was also mesmerized by other things that were going on in the room at the time, and I wasn't able to concentrate properly. Or just a distracted, maybe, is a better word. Maybe even by Prabhupada's personality. But when it came to reading the printed word, I could focus very clearly. I could take my time and I could understand what was what and what the relationship of these different concepts were to one another. And it was all sort of there for me to study. But to try to catch the spoken word in those days is very difficult. No, there was no request to do anything really like that. We did nothing about regulated principles or rounds. We didn't know what rounds were, or no beads or anything. It was just Prabhupada and Srimad Bhagavatam. And what I thought was going to be a Sanskrit class. There was a feast, but it seemed like it was a kind of one-off event that wouldn't happen again. Well, the initiation was an affair where I was walking. I was coming to the temple, and I was feeling great satisfaction, bathing in the morning, and just beginning to feel a kind of change. And I was walking near the temple on 2nd Avenue with Raya Rama, and he said that Swami is going to do an initiation. Would you like to be initiated? And I said, what exactly is it? He said, well, I don't know too much about it, but Swamiji said that it means that you look upon your spiritual master as being as good as God. And I thought for a minute, and I said, well, that sounds okay. Doesn't sound good. But I really didn't know what it meant, but what was going on at the time was a group of people were going to be initiated. This was the first initiation, maybe 7 or 8. And it appeared to me to be still as casual a thing as everything else was, at least in my way of understanding. And I had faith in Prabhupada as having the absolute truth, and what Raya Rama said didn't necessarily mean to me that this is exactly what it was, or maybe even it wasn't what Prabhupada had said it was. It was an impression that he had. It was still a very mysterious thing, but since it was being offered, I thought, why not take advantage of it? It was like the next step to do. But really, had no idea about 16 rounds and about regulative principles. In fact, it wasn't even mentioned. I think until maybe the day before, he had to go out and buy some beads. But definitely there was nothing about 16 rounds. I remember the first time we started chanting with beads, we were doing 2 rounds with Prabhupada sitting in the temple room, doing 2 rounds, holding the beads up and watching all of us to be sure we wouldn't fall asleep. So that's how we started out with the initiations. And then gradually after the initiations, it became more and more clear that, these are the principles, this is what they are. And so the actual feeling of surrender, it came actually quite a bit later in the initiation. And I think that was probably true for most everybody there. In fact, at the first initiation, at the ceremony, there was a fire on a little mound of dirt that devotees brought in. There was nothing. It was right on the floor, on a wooden floor. Square amount of dirt looked like a chocolate cake, and some broken up bits of orange crates, boxes, wooden boxes, little things. And after Prabhupada chanted on our beads, he said to each of us, now you can come up and touch the feet of Lord Chaitanya. Well, I'd never heard the name Lord Chaitanya before. If I did, I didn't remember it. And there was a picture on a little altar of Lord Chaitanya, and he said, now touch your beads to the feet of Lord Chaitanya. So each of us went up and touched our beads to the feet of Lord Chaitanya in this picture, not even knowing what we were doing. So somehow Prabhupada was inducing everybody, taking a great risk in having this initiation just to get things started. And there was no Mangal Arati, there was no 16 rounds, anything of that nature at the time. What would happen is Prabhupada would carry on discourses in his room for hours and hours and hours at a time. There would be some lunch, some prasadam, Prabhupada would serve some of it out personally, and then there would be some more discussion, and shortly after that discussion resumed after eating, Prabhupada would just start to recline. I was only one or two of these sessions. Then he would just take rest. And everyone would just sit and read very quietly. And then after half an hour, almost always, exactly after 30 minutes, pretty much, it was the same amount of time,
He'd open his eyes and sit up, and then the conversation would resume exactly the point it left off, as if he just took a little break to go out of the room. He was so controlled and regulated. Anyway, gradually, you know, he made things more through, mostly through the lectures in the temple. He would explain what the principles were, and then there's a little thing put up on the wall that these are the fences to be avoided, these are the four regulated principles, etc., etc. So it was a kind of an organic start, you might say. I wasn't there then. Actually, I had gone to San Francisco with some blessings from Prabhupada to try to start a temple there. And I got a letter, though, from Prabhupada while I was in San Francisco, and he was very enthusiastic about the fact that this TV show was going to be done. And he described how many men came with many machines. That's what I remember about the letter. With many big machines. And it just had this kind of aura of excitement that all these men came with machines and they were going to make a television broadcast. And I was amazed, actually. When we talked to the devotees and we heard it was going to be done by the local CBS network, you know, there was a sense that Prabhupada's movement was beginning to take hold. It was beginning to take root in a more serious way. In Second Avenue, they were just passing out little tracts. Transcendental sound vibration, stay high forever, no coming down. And it didn't look so impressive, you know, just handing out a few tracts. But when it was going to be televised, and there were some write-ups in the New York Times, it became much more solid. It became clear that Prabhupada was going to make a big impact. The 26th Second Avenue? It would have been, I went to San Francisco in November of 1966, Prabhupada must have been late in 1966, before he came out to San Francisco. So I'd say December, probably.
And when you arrived in the Second Avenue?
When was that?
July.
That was July, of late June or early July of 66. They moved along fast in the sense that after maybe three meetings, the room was always filled. Three nights a week. I mean, literally filled up with people. It was about a third this room in size. And within a few weeks, there were tapestries on the wall. There were big carpets. And Prabhupada had one, Jim Green. I don't remember what his initiated name was. It started with a J. It might have been Jagannath. At any rate, he was painting under Prabhupada's direction. And within a few days, he had this big 1 yard circumference, round picture of Radha and Krishna up on the altar behind Prabhupada. You may have seen that, pictures of that picture. And somebody brought a cymbal from like a drum set and they hung it from the ceiling, and whenever Prabhupada sang, he would play it. I think that was Hayagriva. So all sorts of things were coming. It became very decorated within a short time. Prabhupada's altar had a nice tapestry over it, his little lectern. And of course, Allen Ginsberg started coming in that first few weeks. And when he came, he had so many followers. They all came. They wanted to see what he was going to do, to chant. And he just sat there with everybody. He was quite famous then. So it got very crowded in that room. And it began to grow very fast. That area was very fertile for young people looking for a good time, seeking something. Artists, bohemians, musicians, actors, and sort of thing. Yeah. So, I think we should probably end here. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.